Hello, my friends. Hello, my life warriors, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to the Day In, Day Out podcast. Woo! Today on episode 245, I'm very lucky, privileged to have Alan Stevens on the podcast. He is an international profiler. He is also a communication specialist as well. We talked about many things on the podcast today. Some of the misconceptions which come from profiling. Also, we talked about how he got started in the realm of profiling. And we also talked about his group, which he started, the Campfire Project, where basically where his hashtag is We Work Together. Got to say, very interesting conversation was had. Yeah, we covered the many different things from how he got started, everything like that, and also how, like, some of the misconceptions with regards to communications for men out there in this world today and how they are seen in this world. Got to say, loved the conversation. I look forward to speaking with him again in the future. Anyway, but sit back, enjoy the podcast, and have a great day. Yeah. Peace. Oh, hello, my friends. Hello, my life warriors, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to the Day In, Day Out podcast. Woo! Today on episode 245, I'm very lucky, privileged to have Alan Stevens on the podcast today. He is an international profiler, and communication specialist. How are you today, sir?
Really good, thank you very much.
Now, I have to ask, now, because, like, this is the thing. When I hear profiling, like, what are the misconceptions people often come up with this?
Straight away, it's straight to, is this that SEI stuff, you know, what they see on TV? Is this catching criminals? Mm-hmm. But profiling is really just being able to understand people.
Yes.
And being able to, yes, you can use it for undercover or uncovering whether they're telling the truth and whether they're liars, or you can use it, as I do, to understand them and build stronger relationships.
Mm. I can imagine people, when they find out what you do they get kind of a little bit nervous?
You're quite often the hands come up in front of the face or they start turning the other way. You get that all the time because everyone's worried about what people think of them.
Yeah.
And really, we shouldn't worry about that.
Mm.
Because we're all individuals. We've all got great skills. Everyone's got a gift. And that's what I look for in a person is their gifts, not their where they think they've got their problems.
Yeah, no, I hear that. And, like, you know what? If everyone could take that sort of sage bit of advice, I think the world would be in a better place. But sadly,
definitely,
it doesn't kind of work out like that. But, like, I am kind of keen to know, like, how did you find yourself on this path of, like, profiling and communications?
Well, mainly because I was shocking at reading people. I've been through a couple of divorces. I've had a lot of relationships that were broken and also had business partners that emptied the bank out. Oh. So really what it came down to, I had to learn just for my own survival. And it's been a long process over, well, I started with in 1975 with understanding body language. Mm-hmm. And then into the 80s, it was psychometric profiling, the little twitches or the asking people questions and trying to work out their personalities from there. And then after that, in the 90s, it was a little bit of NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, knowing how to use language. And then in into the early 2000s, I moved into a number of fields like massage therapy, aromatherapies, working with color and sound therapies. And I was working with a company that taught currency trading, and none of their students made any money, so that's why they brought me in to try and figure out why. And I realized that when you ask people questions, they try and second guess the answers. And I needed a system where I could just look at them and work out their personalities without needing to ask them anything. And somebody just said to me, you ever looked at reading faces? So around about 2007, that's when I started looking into that. And I found Paul Ekman, a psychologist in San Francisco who worked with the little twitches on the face, what they call micro expressions.
Yeah.
And from there, I then looked at the facial features as well, put that together with the two of those together with the body language and the micro expression with the NLP, and came up with rapid trait profiling.
Good God. It sounds like a very long and epic sort of journey of learning and self-discovery. Do you find when, like, as you pick up all of this, can you turn it on and off at will? Or is it just like, it's always on, like some like Sherlock Holmes, like come back to Sherlock Holmes?
Yeah. Well, if you look at the two main areas, facial features and facial expressions, facial expressions are used, you know, this is where the CSI stuff starts to come in. It's lie detection. Uh-huh. Well, if I'm at a party, everyone's going to be telling stories. Everyone's going to be embellishing the truth to fit in and have fun. I'll switch that off. But your facial features tell me your personality. And if I can see your personality, I know how to speak to you in the way that you want to be spoken to, which means I'm going to have a bit more enjoyable time with you. And so are you. Uh-huh. So that part I never turn off. So if I can see you, the moment you're walking across the room in my direction, I've got your personality before you get to me. I know how you take information in, how you process it, how much space you need. And at that point, I can then know how to get the conversation going. And then I've got the body language to give me a bit of an indication there. And, yeah, I might turn the micro expressions on at that point just to pick up where there's something emotionally going on. But as far as in an interview, yeah, or a interrogation, those sort of things, yep, the micro expression side of it, looking for the truth, that's going to be turned on.
Mm, interesting, interesting. I often think, like, yes, like, we often look at ourselves in this world as very sort of unique sort of snowflakes. And like, oh, yes, I'm special and all of this. But like, does it sort of like, you know, I go, you might think that, but you guys are in this sort of personality type. You guys are in this personality type and you guys are in this personality type. It's not as expansive as many people think it is.
Well, actually, it's probably more expansive. Really? Because when you look at psychometric profiling, they put people in boxes, and that's when you say, oh, you guys fit into this group and you guys fit into that group. But that's an extremely disrespectful way of reading people. And it's when you ask people questions to put them in those boxes, you're not taking consideration of the gender. You're not taking consideration of the education levels or their emotions on the day. Mm-hmm. All you're really doing is getting a reading of the person in that moment. You change the situation around them, and I guarantee their personality will come out differently when you ask questions. But by looking at facial features, and I'm looking at about 68 traits in total in the face and a few in the body, 39 of them, you either have an extreme at that end, in the middle, or extreme at the other end. Now, I work on a sliding scale. When I teach people, it's A, B, and C. And about 29 traits, you either have it or you don't. So the possible combinations there is 3 to the power of 39 times 2 to the power of 29. It's a massive number. It's two with about 27 characters after it. So everybody is unique. Now, when a lot of people say, yes, I'm special, well, they're saying it because they hope they are, but they don't believe it. But when I profile people, I say, look, you are uniquely different to everybody else on the planet. So you are special. You have a gift that nobody else has. And once that's what the profiling does, it allows me to find that combination of traits, see where your real gifts are, and therefore show you how you are uniquely different to everybody else on the planet. Mm-hmm. You are special.
Why, thank you. I like being special. Thank you very much. You're most kind. Hear that, people? I am special. Yes. Not in the way those other doctors said. But yeah. So when people come up to you and they know what you do and everything like this, what is that typical question they ask? Because I imagine you get it a number of times, just like because they're trying to unlock that little thing that they want to know about themselves in some respects.
They always quite often lead in with, can you tell me something about me? It's always at the front end. You know, they say, oh, can you tell me something about me, Alan? I go, okay, well, then I can work through the things from there. But the other side of it is quite often if somebody comes up to me and they pull their phone out, I know there's a good chance they want me to talk about their spouse or their children, or I'm just about to start dating this person. You reckon I should or I shouldn't? So it comes into that level as well.
Just like, yeah, should I date this person? Yeah. Like, yeah, I think the axe and the bloody knife might be like, but I think
it might be a giveaway. Leave that one alone.
He was like, no, well, no, sweetie, no. So, like, trying to figure out other people. Yeah, you know, like, this must be one of those things which, as you go through life, you go, right, I'm doing this. I've, like, life has not been easy in any way. People most probably take it as a surprise that you have, like, problems with your own relationships. You've had problems where you've been, like, yeah, taken advantage of over the course of time. Like, do you still find that with all the training you've had and everything like this, it's still sometimes very hard to still read people?
It can be a little bit harder where it's not as obvious. As far as the facial features go, I can pick that up. That's going to be easy on everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But when they it depends on if they're trying to hide something. If they're towards being a narcissist or a sociopath, etc., that side of things, it takes a little bit longer. But the quickest thing is that this is why I'm using all those skills together, because it's their interaction, the combination between them.
Mm-hmm.
So if a person's face tells me that their personality is going to be a certain way, and then when I'm talking, they're behaving some way differently, I'm then looking for, is there something emotionally going on, or is there something that they're lying about here? Is there something in their character?
Mm.
Because I know there used to be a belief that bumps on the head, phrenology, those people would be, you know, serial killers and sort of thing, that sort of thing. That was debunked. That was all about character.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, the way the facial features work, if you lift weights in your body, you know, you do bicep curls, for instance, you're going to build your biceps up. You won't work, if you don't work the triceps, you're not going to build those. So whatever muscle you work over and over is going to take shape. Same thing when you're thinking. You will pull expressions while you're thinking, because everything we feel inside we express outwardly. That's why the body language and the little expressions we have on our face give away how we're feeling. So when you're thinking in a certain way, you're going to be pulling expressions, and that movement of the muscles over and over again is going to create ridges and crevices on your face that give away your personality, how you like to think, not what you're thinking.
Right.
And so that's why it's always easy to read someone's personality, and then to work out their character. That can take, it can be very quick, because people will respond exactly the same as their personality, or there'll be some differences there, and you go, okay, what's going on here? What's the cause of the difference? So you may have to look a little bit deeper for that.
Well, you must be having a smorgasbord of information coming off my face then. Just like, yes, I'm constantly going through the mental, like, acrobatics when I do podcasts again and again and again. But that's another story. It's not about me. So with this, like, so how have, like, what would you say have been some of the sort of big differences, changes, lessons you've learned over the course of time with, like, your training over this period?
Well, with the training, it's been an ongoing education. So I've been learning new things all the way through. I think one constant thing within it has been realizing that the most important thing I'll ever learn was the next thing I'll learn after I think I know everything. So I was always learning and adding more things to it. But I started to change my attitude towards myself, because when I was making all the mistakes in the past, you beat yourself up. Why should I be doing this? Then when you start to learn some skills and you start to have better communications and relationships with people, that's when you start to find out who you are as a real person, because you're no longer caught up in the emotions of not fitting in to now fitting in, but now you can look at yourself a bit deeper.
Mm.
And in that's when I started to realize a lot more about myself and how I could improve my community, my environment. And, you know, everybody is really good when we're children at reading people. This is something I'd always like to point out, because everybody who's listening to this, they might think this is a magical skill to have. But every child, except for a very small percentage of children who had certain conditions, were expert at reading people when they were young. They had to be able to recognize the facial features, to know whether we knew the person or we didn't know them. Mm. If they did know them, were they somebody we should be around or not around? Then we needed to be able to recognize their emotions, their expressions, their body language, to know whether the person was happy or sad or angry or whatever, and then put that together with the facial features and go, okay, I recognize a person. It's somebody I shouldn't be around, and they're looking pretty angry. The warning is, get the hell out of there. But if the person was a friend who was angry, then you might want to go to them and find out what's going on. So understanding the combination, and that's why when I first started doing this and I heard Paul Ekman with the facial expressions, only doing that, he looked at the facial features and went, no, that doesn't make any sense. People who work with the facial features were looking at the facial expressions going, I don't understand that. Mm. But they correlate. They work with each other. They confirm what you're seeing, one in the other. And so everybody, but as we get older, as young children, we start to get involved in sports and school and other things. And it's like, as they say, if you're being fit, you've been working out, then you stop working out, those muscles are going to atrophy. It's the same thing with your ability to read people. So everybody has an innate ability to read people, but as we get older, that may just fit into the background. But how many times have you heard somebody speak and everything they said sounded perfectly fine, but you just had that gut feeling, nah, something's wrong here. Mm. Well, that's because unconsciously you've picked up the nonverbal indicators, little twitches on the face, the body language, the tone of voice, all those little nuances can give you or give away that it doesn't correlate with what they're saying in the words they've said. And so all I really do in the work I do with people, regardless of whether it be a large corporation or a parent, a school teacher, is remind them and help bring back that re-exercise that muscle they had when they were children. Yeah. So anybody can learn what I do. And so it wasn't anything marvelous that I actually learned it. I just found a number of good teachers to teach me their areas. And then I just saw the value of putting them together into one program.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Because like this is the thing. I was, how long ago? Must have been just over a year ago. I was listening to Michelle Obama's book. And basically when she was on the campaign trail, so she was doing a number of different speeches, left, right, and center. You know how we all know how American politics works. Mm. Nightmare there it is sometimes. But every time she went on stage, like she would do, like she would give the speech, be very eloquent, like everything like that. And the very sort of next day or the few hours after, they would lose points. And like they kept doing it. And then like one day, like it was like, yes, she was like, yeah, I'm doing what you want. And like, you know, and they're like, okay, yeah. They went, now we want you to sit down, watch your last speech. And they showed it to her with the sound on. I went, okay. Now watch it again. And they turned the sound off. And it was like, oh, it was like, can you see the difference? Because it's one of those things where when you're articulate, when you feel like you're like projecting your voice in a certain way, it's a case of you're not sometimes aware of how that body comes across, because you know what I mean? I could be reading a children's story, but like you're like, yeah, once upon a time, verbal cues compared to the body language doesn't sometimes match up to what we think.
That's it. You know? Yeah. See, this is when I first did my initial training with looking at the micro expression, whether somebody was telling the truth. And after my first training, people would say, well, what's the best way to watch a video and work out whether someone's telling the truth or not, like politicians speaking or on the campaign trail, or a news article where somebody is a reporter is asking questions, say a business person. And people record it and they watch it and they listen to it at the same time. I go, no, play it with the sound off first of all and look for the body movements. We focus in on that and you'll see different expressions and things. And after you watch it a couple of times, then watch it with the sound on, because now the brain knows when those switches in the body language and the way they were standing, the way they're moving, the expressions on their face. And when the sound's there, you go, oh, I can, you know straight away whether they've been telling the truth or not. So, because the trouble is, when we were kids at school, we were told to listen. When we were growing up around our families, it was be quiet and listen. And you had to use your ears. And the ears were the things that we used the most of. But what I keep telling everybody is we've got two ears, we've got two eyes and one mouth. And we use them in that proportion. So our eyes will pick up so much more. And if we're listening to the words, if I said to you a sentence like, I didn't say she stole the money, and it's just a flat monotone sentence, it's got one meaning. But if I say, I didn't say she stole the money, I'm inferring that somebody else did. If I didn't say she stole the money, then I'm inferring something else again. And so I didn't say she stole the money. Well, then I could have written it down. So the words, the inflection in the voice changes a lot of things. And when people do put inflection on a word, there's usually a bit of a movement in the body as well. Like, as I say, if I said, I didn't say she stole the money, there'll be an expression or whatever that goes with it. If you watch a video with the sound off, you'll see all of that stuff, because that's what you're concentrating on. So we take in about 2 million bits of information every second through all of our senses. But when we're concentrating and processing that information, we're processing about 134 bits. The major, major bulk of it, we don't process. It's like you can be standing next to somebody else, listening to people. One of you, you'll hear the noises around. The other person may not hear the noises around. Another person may feel the change in temperature. And other people don't even notice a change in temperature. It depends on where your focus goes. So by narrowing the focus down, by shutting off the sound itself and just watch the movements, that's when you'll pick up so much. And then turn it back on later on. Now your brain is triggered to know when that change is going to come. And now you're listening to the words at that time and it becomes a lot more obvious.
Ah, I see. Now, you must have a very interesting time if you watch a court trial or anything like this, because you're like, you go, oh, wait a second. You're telling the truth, or, oh, you son of a bitch. You're lying through your teeth. Because like, if I had your skill set, even though I have not been paying attention to a lot of it, but like, I can't help it, the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp trial, I'll be watching it like there was no tomorrow. Just like, okay, oh, ooh. Like the amount of R's and O's my order would be coming off of me, like be off the scale, just to say the least.
I always say to people, don't focus in too, if you're going to do that, don't focus in too hard, because what you're doing is you're narrowing your gaze when you do it. Sit back and relax. Sit back so you've got the wider vision, you're taking everything in, because say in a court case, you've got the jury, you've got the lawyers or solicitors asking the questions, you've got the person in the box that's been asked the questions, the witness. And so if you just look at one, you might miss what's going on with the jurors, because you like to know what they're thinking as well. What are they picking up? And which jurors are really picking up what's happening, and others who are sort of oblivious to it? Because some people are very attuned to picking the variations up in body language and things, whereas other people just miss it all completely. And so you can work out, well, who's actually picking up what's going on here? So you widen your view. You can pick up little bits from everybody and you can piece a lot more together.
Excellent. Taking that God's eye point of view rather than...
Yeah. Well, it's like, if you look at when you're standing there in front of somebody, you actually get your gaze taking in the whole face. Mm-hmm. And when you do that and you soften it, you can also see the extremities. You can see the arms, you can see the legs if you're standing far enough back. And in that, you can see any variations, any movements. And if you just broaden your gaze, any little bit over here, over there, down here, up there, all of those little movements, you'll start to piece things together. But always, I always look at when it comes to the evidence side of things, the body language, the expressions, you look to see whether it's congruent, whether it's in context with what's happening, and you're always looking for indicators in clusters. Mm. You get that one little look of contempt on someone's face as one side of the mouth just switches up. Now, that could be, you see that on someone's face, and go, oh, there was a bit of contempt. But it could be like right at the moment when I'm articulating a lot, my nose starts to get itchy because on the surface of the face, all the nerve cells are very close to the surface. There's a lot of blood. So while you're articulating a lot, the skin is going to get agitated. And in that, you'll start to get an itchy nose. But somebody scratching their nose, I'm asking, are they scratching their nose while you're talking to them? Or are they scratching their nose as they're talking like I am now and putting their hand up here and scratching around? Then they're trying to cover up. So if I'm always mindful, if I'm talking to people and I know my face is getting really itchy, I'll finish what I'm saying, there'll be a pause, and then I'll scratch my face. Because it's not a covering up now, it's actually trying to get the nerve endings in my face to relax. So everything we feel is going to cause the blood to move around our body. You know, the old story of Pinocchio, his nose grew when he told lies. Well, it is true, but it doesn't grow outward, it grows inward. Because the inside of the nose has got erectile tissue. And that erectile tissue has got to be there. It's part of our cleaning system, our immune system. So that when we breathe, the inside of the nose is expanding and closing. One nose, we're not breathing through both nostrils at the same time. We're breathing through one as one shuts off, the other one opens up. Then it starts to shut down and the other one opens up. And this causes the air to circulate and throw all the impurities out and get caught in the surface inside of the nose and the hairs. And that's part of our cleaning system. So if you're articulating a lot and you're starting to worry about, well, first of all, you're articulating, you're going to have the nerve ending starting to pick up. If someone's telling a lie, the blood's going to be coming to their faces and they're going to start to get an itchy nose.
Ah.
So depending on when you're asking questions, and if they're answering and they're scratching the nose a lot, something's going on. But you've got to ask yourself, that's why I said not just on one indicator, is it because they've been talking for a lot? Or is it because they are telling a lie and the nerve endings and that are being triggered?
Interesting. Now, you see, as I talk to you, like there's a, you remind me of this TV show. What was it? I think it was called Lie to Me. It was on for, I think, about 2 or 3 seasons. And whole sort of giving the eyes and stuff like this.
And that's how the micro expressions work. That was Tim Roth was the actor in it. He played the psychologist. The Paul Ekman was the man who did all the research on the micro expressions, started them back in 1969 when he did his degrees at university. He was he went to Papua New Guinea to the Foray tribe. He was the only white man they'd ever seen in their life. No radios, no TVs. And he wanted to work out what expressions were universal. So when Charles Darwin traveled the world, 1872, he was saying that he couldn't understand what people were saying, but he could understand their emotions or what they were feeling from the expressions on their face. So he knew their emotions. And for about 95 years, all the anthropologists were saying, no, that's rubbish. He's talking about it being innate, being part of our nature traits. And the anthropologists are saying, no, it's cultural. It's all about the nurture side of things. Well, Paul wanted to prove one way or the other. And even though the face can pull over, let's say, 10,000 expressions, and there's 3,000 that he and his team worked out the muscle movements for each of those, but they found that there were 7 expressions which are universal. It doesn't matter if you've been born in a capital city, a tribal village, or blind from birth. If you feel either anger, contempt, disgust, happiness, sadness, or fear or surprise, if you feel any one of those emotions inside, you're going to have the corresponding expression on your face. And because it's happens in what we call a micro expression, when something happens around you, something is said to you or something is picked up, unconsciously we react to it and the expression will occur. Then our conscious mind steps in and shuts it off. So we'll look at if you're talking to somebody, you're talking about one of their good friends who is just broken up from their partner, and you see a little twitch of a smile, a very quick twitch. It can be as fast as a fifth of a second down to 1/25th of a second. You know that they're happy about it, but you don't know why. That's why you need to ask a few more questions. It could be that, oh, yeah, my friend, they're going to be better off being away from that person. That person was horrible. They were a psychopath or a narcissist or whatever.
Yeah.
It could be that, my friend, it's about time they got a bit of a kick in the ass. They've been too smug lately. Or it could be even that, hey, the other person now is gone. And they're no longer going out with my friend. They're now available. I might have a shot myself. So it could be a whole mass of different reasons. So you've always got to check everything, test it. Don't assume. Because that's one of the biggest problems. When people start to learn this, the first thing they do is go out and they think they know everything. And they start to try and impress everybody. Me, I pull back and take more time. The more I know, the more I check it. And that way, then I'm respecting the other person and respecting myself in the process as well.
I don't know why the sort of analogy of the old bull and the young bull comes to mind, but I can see why people can be very sort of bullish with this sort of like acquiring this type of skill set. Because, how can I say? Newfound power. I'm not going to say magic trick because that'll be, I think, disrespectful, but newfound power is one of those things people have to kind of learn how to wield it, and not knowing, like, not respecting that, that can get people into all manners of like trouble or just like
See, if I'm want to analyze people, want to turn around to everybody and tell everybody what I'm seeing, that's my ego. I want to be able to assist. So I run a group called the Campfire Project, and I originally put that together as a safe place where men could come along and tell their stories, because we knew a lot of men in business, they're saying all the gender equality, all the political correctness, got to be careful about what we say. The way we used to talk was okay, but now we can get into trouble for it. And oh, they're still getting frustrated. They were also telling me that at home, they thought, well, especially Gen Ys and Gen X, or Gen X, I should say, and the baby boomers, our role was to go out and raise the funds and, show our family our love for them by bringing the resources in. But while we're out there getting the resources, we're not at home. So next thing you know, we're being told that we're emotionally and physically disconnected. And so with that, men were getting frustrated. And in some cases, the men were moving on to being angry and resentful. And in some cases, that led to bullying in the workplace and even domestic violence. And you don't fix a bully by beating a bully up. What you do is you understand the cause of the bullying, where it came from, and do something about that. So I thought, right, let's have a safe place where men could come along, sit down and tell their stories in safety, no counselling, no advice or anything else, just listen to them. Again, being those two ears, two eyes and one mouth. And when I sit with somebody, I ask questions. And only when I've exhausted all my questions, I've got one more question. And that is when I'm talking to somebody, okay, from everything that you've been telling me, this is how I'm understanding it. Have I got it right? Now I'm into a conversation with them. But the group wasn't just for men. I realized that Me Too and Men Too were great when it came to highlighting all the problems in society, but they weren't going to be the solution because everyone's pointing fingers. It's only when we stand shoulder to shoulder. So I brought the women into the group from day one, so they could hear how men could speak when the men felt safe to do so. And then we had panel discussions on masculinity, pornography, femininity, you name it, we were talking about it. And the women in the group started sending me personal messages going, we love these guys. We've never heard men speak so deeply about their emotions. How can we get involved? Put your hands up. So they came into the one-on-ones, joined the panel discussions. And we've talked about menstruation, menopause. We even talked about, does size matter in the bedroom? And as I always say to everybody, if they want to know the answer to that one, they'll have to come into the Campfire Project and listen to the video. get the answer to it. But what we found was that by having respect for people, with me sitting back, I interview somebody after I introduce them on the video and then ask them, you know, to tell me about why they're doing what they're doing today, what brought them to this, what's their story. I'll be quiet and I can sit there for 45 minutes. If they're able to keep talking, I'll let them go, because their unconscious mind is steering their conscious mind where it needs to go, so they get their answers. So this becomes the best sort of therapy that they can get without having somebody talking at them. And in that, I'll sit there for 40, 45 minutes without saying a word. And they tell me this is the best therapy. So in doing that, I've learnt when I do profiling or anything else is to respect the person that I'm working with. Even if I've got someone, if I'm trying to figure out whether they're telling the truth or not, whether they're liars or whatever, I'll still respect them in that space, because the more they feel that I'm respecting them, the more I can elicit the real truth from them and the more they'll give things away. But if I stand up there like the young buck and go, hey, beat my chest and say, look at me, well, the one who's not going to pick anything up is going to be me. The other people will be able to read me and control me very easily in the way that they answer questions. Mm. So I have the power by sitting back and taking that respectful position, and people, what they tell me, I get a surprise at times, the amount they just unload in no time at all.
Yeah. No, I can imagine with, like, regarding the Campfire Project, that, how can I put it? We live in a today's society where you can communicate with people so easily. You can, like, back in the day, long distance telephone calls cost a fortune. Now you can just communicate for free. Video communication. Yes, you needed a big truck to, like, connect to a satellite, and now we can do it over the internet. But with all of this communication, with all of this connection we share in this world, it is quite superficial, and there is no sort of deepness to it. What would you say were, like, some of the surprises you found when you first started, the Campfire Project on that sort of basis?
Well, I started realizing just how many people were hurting. And then I stopped and I looked at it. And I know there was an FBI profiler, which his name, Chase Hughes. He had four points that he pointed out. And I realized I've been working with those for the last 20, 30 years. And the first one is that everybody is suffering or has suffered. Mm-hmm. The second point, everybody wears a mask. Third point, everybody pretends they're not wearing a mask. And everybody is the combination of their childhood sufferings and rewards. So everybody has got some insecurities in their makeup. So with all of that, people are wanting to be seen to be great, but they doubt themselves, but they will put it out there that they're great, but underneath they're not feeling that way. The number of people I've spoken to in just over three years, going on to 4 years now, we've had over 500 hours of video conversations in the Campfire Project, over 320 one-on-ones, and then a whole bunch of panel discussions. And in those 320 one-on-one discussions, everybody has come in, but by the time we've finished the conversation, they've opened up so much and felt comfortable and safe enough to show that part of themselves they weren't even admitting that they had. And they've opened up completely. And so I realized the one thing when it comes to reading people, my priority is to respect them in the process, regardless of who they are. Because if I do that, as I said, they will tell me more and I'll be able to pick up more. Mm. So not about my ego of being able to read them. It's about whether, you know, am I reading that person right? And what am I really picking up? If somebody's not telling me the truth, it's not necessarily that they're just trying to lie to everybody. It could be they're lying to themselves. There's something that they're not willing to face up to themselves. And if I can meet them at their level and make that connection with them, it's surprising how many of them just open up and started admitting to themselves where they're really at. And for being in that position, for me, that's quite humbling. You know, I have a lot of gratitude for the people I'm talking to because, you know, they open up, they trust me enough to share their life story with me. And I'd be a pretty crap person if I was arrogant about that. I hear. Gotta have respect for those people.
No, and like this is the thing. Anytime someone shares themselves and opens themselves up to be vulnerable, it is one of those things where you got to treat that as delicately as like can be. Because as soon as you start abusing that, it's like yes, that sort of soft center can become very hard and resentful rather quickly, or you can break it rather quickly as well. Now, I'm also keen to know, like, when you started out, it was just a men's group, and when you started to add ladies to that mix, how the dynamic may have shifted? Because look, guys being guys, when the guys are just around, they are one way, and as soon as you introduce ladies into the mix, they can be another, you know?
Well, see, that's where I was quite sneaky, because the women were in the group from the very first day. And when I advertised as a place where men could come and give themselves permission to tell their stories. Yeah, because I don't believe, I heard people say, oh, it's up to the community to give men permission. Don't be so arrogant. It's not the community's responsibility is to create a safe place so men can then give themselves permission to tell their stories. Yeah. And I'd been talking about that and promoting that. And I had some women that I really knew well, several dozen of them, who came into the group and were sitting there in day one. So they were sitting there, and I knew that the men, when they came in, because of the way I was talking and were lazy these days, I knew that most men wouldn't go and check all the names in the membership. They'd come in. They would then open up. So they started opening up without even knowing that the women were there. But I knew that the women who were there would respect them. And anybody who comes in, there are two questions they have to answer. Both questions are the same. They're just reworded. And really, they're just asking, will you respect everybody? Mm. And the people who are twigged and said, Alan, you've asked the same question twice. Why didn't you ask a different question? And I said, because there's your two chances. You don't get a third. Once you come in, you say you're going to be respectful. The moment you're disrespectful, you're out. And with that, we haven't had any problems, because everybody then realized, if I'm disrespectful, you're saying that everybody else, if they're disrespectful, they're out. So if I tell my story and open my heart up and tell you everything, and nobody's going to have a shot at me, they felt safer. And so most of the men didn't even know the women were there, until the women started putting some comments on the post when they were up there going, oh, this is wonderful, and talking about how amazed they were with the men and what they've been through and how they were handling things. And then I brought the men into the panel discussions. As I said, the women, I already had it in my mind from the day one. I wanted the men to be able to lead the way. Women are just as capable to lead the way, but the problems we have in society is so many men don't feel like they measure up. And so they needed a place where they could feel that they'd got it together, and then have the women start to follow them. Well, now the women are walking side by side with them in the group.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's been just so powerful.
Yeah. I would say, with regards to many respects to sort of male identity in this day and age, it is, as you mentioned earlier, The typical male role back in the day was, yes, I go out, I work, I bring back money, and we go forward. But this is, I do all of this, and I'll play with the kid occasionally, and off you go, because, man, must make money, bring back goods and stuff like this. But now, today, where a large percentage of guys will not earn more money than the ladies they might actually get with. So they're not going to be the sort of main breadwinner. And basically that sort of degree of flexibility, where people are now working from home a lot more, trying to sort of fit in and figure out what a man is. No, that's just sort of too generic. It's just many different things. What am I as a husband or a partner? What am I as a father? What am I in my sort of social group and maybe society on a greater level? It's not a simple question, and it's not a question I think which is broached enough times. Well, if it is, it's sort of just like superficial and it hasn't really been sort of really tackled on a greater meaning. Do you be soft? Should you be softer? Should you be harder? Or like, how does that work? You know?
Yeah, they talk about, well, first of all, a work-life balance. Mm. Well, I talk about a work-life harmony. Your home life and your work life, there's got to be a harmony there. It's the same thing in a relationship. You know, some days you're going to be feeling great and your partner's going to feel down. It's going to, be the other way around. It's a partnership. That's what we start to forget. We've got to realize that, yes, we need to bring money in to pay for the bills and everything, or money's got to come into the household. Mm. There's also, if you've got children and everything else, there's also looking after the house itself. All of those are important parts of it. And, you know, if you've got one partner who's out putting all the time into raising funds, the one who's at home, making sure the home's right, looking after the kids and everything else, if they weren't doing that, the other person couldn't be out making the money. So we're trying to see, well, who's more important and who's not important. The thing is, you don't have the whole without everybody playing their part. So each one is just as important as the other. So in communications, we talk about, first of all, the words, the tone of the voice and the body language. Now, if you're talking about 100% of the communication, those three components make that up. The words are only worth 7% as far as the actual words themselves. The tone of voice is 38 and the body language is 55. So everybody goes, oh, well, the body language has got to be the most important thing. Mm. It will give you more information than the actual words themselves. But without the words, you're not going to get any information. So importance-wise, they are equally important. But the value you get from one area or the other might be different because of the percentages. Mm. This is where this argument, people were saying, talking about the 7%, the 38%, the 55% all over the place. And others came along and said, well, that's all wrong. It's the same with the psychologists when they first started with fighting over its nature and others fighting over its nurture. No, it's a combination of both. Everything's got to work together. That's why the Campfire Project has a hashtag we together, because nothing works unless we work together. Mm. Try and do it on your own. Well, how many guys out there that we see it in politicians, we see it in our sporting stars, we see it in our entertainers. They're all trying, you know, the men are trying to be the man and the women are trying to be the woman, when really we'd be happier if we tried to be a man and the women tried to be a woman. Because when you're doing those, if you're trying to be the person, there's only one the. So you're in competition with everybody else, is why there's so much bad behavior. But if you're trying to be a man or a woman, who else do you want around you? Others who are doing the same thing. Now you have a community. That's the difference in having a strong community. We don't need all these people out there, these shock jocks and all the rest of it that we see on the social media and on the reality shows and, you know, on the news. We don't need that rubbish. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, as far as it comes to being manhood, and you talk about good men and bad men, no, we've got boys and we've got men. And some boys will go to their grave, they're very old in their age, and never have made it to men because of their behaviour. When it comes down to it, are you a man? Then you have a certain behaviour. You can be soft, you can be hard, when it's appropriate. It's like people told me when I was growing up, Alan, get rid of your anger. Well, the anger kept me alive. But then I realised it's how you use the anger. You know, if somebody attacked you or your family, for instance, you're not going to sit back and turn the other cheek. You're going to get angry. Mm. So anger has its place. So knowing all the emotions we have, knowing the right time to use those. So for a man to know when to be soft, to be able to pick flowers, you know, to smell the roses and other things, and when it's time to then stand up and defend. Mm. You know, that's the thing. It's a harmony between all of those, not a balance of them, but a harmony of them, because change is always happening. And we need to be able to go with the flow. So we need to be able to draw on all those skills. And if we're trying to be the man or the woman, we're never going to get there because we're missing all those other attributes that make us whole. They're all empty people. I see so many people out there beating their chests and carrying on. Everyone's putting them on pedestals and I just feel sorry for them. Because when I look at them, I just see them as so empty.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I hear you. And like this is the thing, like very wise sage words from a man down under, which like, come on now, because like, yes, Look like bloke culture, and like, yeah, being that, you know what I mean, like strong guy is one of the things which strongly identifies with the sort of Australian men psyche, if you get what I mean, where I think many which I think sadly many a guy falls into that trap when they desperately need that sort of helping hand. They call it arrogance, call it pride, or just call it fear itself. They rather than reaching out for that sort of helping hand, it holds guys back, if you get what I mean. And you can like go with the sort of muro macho across the world where that is the sort of common theme. Like, I'm a guy, I got to take care of it myself. Like, holding the line, but like the holding the line by yourself is not the way to do it. Like, you got to always look to your left, look to your right. No, you've got people who are there to support you. And when you put your hand behind you, knowing you've got people who have your back to like take things forward. Sadly, I think in this world with regards to the screaming minority, which seem to like focus us in the most negative, that most divisive ways in this world, it keeps us apart. It keeps us in this place of sometimes despair, which I like think we need to fight so hard against. And sometimes it feels like we're losing the battle, to be honest, you know?
Yeah, I've listened to many in the Campfire Project. I've heard, doing Facebook Lives, talking about things around them and getting so emotional about some of the great things that happened in their lives. And you know, they even cry. And two guys in particular, they just did they just did a run recently, what we called a 4x4x48 for charity. They did the 4 miles every 4 hours for 48 hours. And, you know, the amount of energy that took and the dedication and stamina, especially when the winds were howling, it was raining, they almost got washed out and everything else. And they were running in, one was in Melbourne and one was up towards the other side of towards Brisbane. And so these two men have started a charity. They haven't met each other yet face-to-face. Everything's been done on Zoom and Facebook Lives. They're about to get together and run from Sydney to Melbourne and hand out these very bright yellow socks with little black dots on them and a smiley face. The black dots are the tough times we go through in life. We're not going to get out of them. They're going to happen regardless. But the yellow is the warmth of the winter sun, the camaraderie, the support of the right people around you. They hand these socks out and they have conversations about mental health. Mm. And their goal is to run from Sydney to Melbourne. And as they go down through all the towns along the coast, stop and have conversations and hand out 10,000 pairs of these socks and therefore start 10,000 conversations on mental health. Now, they have been doing this for a while, running around different areas like Scott down in Melbourne. He went up to four police who were standing there. It was a demonstration. He went up to each of them and four of them are together. And they're sort of going, looking at him and going, you know, what are you doing? And he just walked over and he gave them a pair of socks each and then told them the story of the socks and chatted with them and said, look, no, you're going through the same thing that we're going through. You live in the same area, so you've got the same pressures on you. We also know you've got the extra pressures because here you are, you have to follow rules and regulations, even if you don't agree with it, because that's your job. Well, by the time he left, all four of them were standing there in tears with the fact that somebody actually noticed them, that realised what they were going through. When you realise that there isn't a person on the planet that if you put them in that position where you get them to open up, that their emotions won't come out. And if they've been bottled down for so long, all these guys who have got to hold it down and be the best and stand up and always be right, they're the ones that will cry the most when you get them into that point, because they can't hold it down forever. If you hold it down, that's when you get mental health issues. And a lot of the people who have got this stigma about mental health and say, I don't want to talk about that stuff, are the ones that are going through the toughest times. So to get them to open up in a safe environment, they then start to realize that, hey, everybody is somewhere on the scale. Most people are luckily down one end, they're happy, but you get up one day and you're happy, and another day you get up and you're miserable. You know, things have gone wrong, everything seems to go wrong and you're unhappy. Well, it just means you slid along that line a little bit. The next day you could be happy again. So we're all on the scale, but which end of the scale are we on this moment? And once we realize that if you get enough pressure dumped on you, you can very quickly go to the far end on the other end. Once you realize that, we should then be looking and go, okay, this isn't a stigma about this. This is just something, a natural part of emotions of life. And therefore, anybody who is going through emotional stuff, have a lot more empathy for them, because for the luck of the draw is they're at that end. We might be down this end, but tomorrow it could be the other way around. Once we realize that we're human, that we're mostly emotional, like we buy a product or a service, yes, we logically need, say, a car, for instance. So there's a logical part of it, but the type of car we buy is all emotional. So we're about 82% emotion and only 18% logic. So if we're emotional beings, and anybody who says, no, I don't show my emotions, get them in the right position, I guarantee they'll pour it out. Because if they don't, they'll break.
Yeah, no, I agree. And when you mentioned, those guys doing the 4-4-48, I've done that twice in my myself, inspired by David Goggins. I don't know if you know him.
That's where it came from.
Yes, basically a guy who sort of exhilarates a sort of different sort of mental sort of toughness with regards to making basically putting yourself in a place of discomfort on a regular basis to help improve. But this is the thing with what you're doing, you're also doing the same thing, but it's not through physical activity. It's just through having these conversations, having this communication on a regular basis, having that sort of self-reflection right. Because when we're in that realm of self-reflection, if we're really doing it properly, you see the good, you see the bad, and then sometimes you see the beautiful, and then you see the damn right ugly, which exists within us all. And it comes down to this, whether you can sort of look at all aspects of that and go, yeah, this is me.
That's it.
I don't think many people often do that. And when they don't do that, they do end up being broken, and they seldomly see who they are truly.
And if you don't want to look at the ugly side of our personalities or our behaviors, etc., then we're never going to be able to see the true beauty of it. Because if you imagine if you lived in utopia, where it's supposed to be everything's brilliant and lovely, fantastic all the time. Well, after a while, it becomes the norm, and it's no longer that anymore. You need some of the downtimes and that to appreciate just how good the uptimes are. They're part and parcel of the whole process. The other side of the coin, so to speak. As I keep saying to people, you can't have an inside without an outside, or an upside down without a downside. There's always got to be, otherwise it doesn't exist. It's got to be more than one dimension. And so with that, once you realize that, there are going to be some tough times, but the question is, how do you handle those tough times? And this is another reason why I profile people, is to be able to understand where people are at, not to judge them, not to make myself feel better than them, but to be able to realize that, how can I be of service to them? I know in business they talk about being a servant boss, and I go, I'll never be a servant boss. I'll be a serving boss, but I'll never be a servant. Because what I'm trying to do is, a servant can only hand up, but as somebody who serves can hand across, they can hand down, they can help everybody around, and whether they're above them or beneath them, so to speak, in where they're at in their emotions at the time. So serving people is extremely important. And with that, you can't have arrogance. You're looking, well, how can I serve that person? The focus is on the other person to be able to help them. And this is why the Campfire Project, which is my passion project, and my business of being a profiler, they're connected all the time. Everything I do is relationships. It's understanding people's relationships and building relationships with them. When we do that, then you have communication. They talk about know, like, and trust. In business, they say, nobody does business with anybody they don't know, like, and trust. Well, first of all, the person's got to like you before they listen to you. And then when they're listening to you, that's when you can build trust, and that's when they buy from you. Now, everything we do in life is a sale. So, imagine you go out the first time, you're trying to find that perfect partner, and you think you found them. There's a sale in itself, because now you're trying to sell them on the idea that they should spend the rest of their life with you. That is a massive sale. And then when you have children, it's a case of trying to get them to eat their broccoli. Now there's a sale and a half, getting them to eat their vegetables. You know? So everything in life is a sale. You know, every communication, it's getting the other person to accept, to really buy what we're giving them or putting in front of them, buying it that it's true, that it's a benefit to them. Because everybody wants to know that they're loved. And that means that we need to feel that we contribute, that we belong, that we have a place, that we're valued. So whether that be a love relationship or even work colleagues, we all needed that. Our children need that from us. We need that from our partners. Once we realize that, we can get by this business of, okay, who's the breadwinner in the family? You know, if the woman is in a role where she can earn more money, great. And the guy should be proud of the fact of what he does at home and looks after the kids and everything else, because she couldn't do that if he wasn't doing that.
Mm.
And that's when I got a lot more respect for mothers. My first wife, when she left, I had three boys to raise on my own. They were 4, 11, and 12. So raising them, I just left my job with a government job. I took redundancy and left and started my own business. And so now I'm running a business and I've got three boys that I'm raising, three sons. And so I realized then just how much the woman or the partner in a relationship brings into all of, you know, whether the man or the woman who stays at home, looks after the kids, just how much they do. If any of the guys out there think that, you know, with their egos, they're making money and they're you know, they talk about the little wife or the little woman at home, get over it. You know, what you've got is somebody you should be respecting and loving, because you wouldn't be able to do what you're doing without their support. Mm. You know? And if they're unhappy and you've got kids, then your kids are going to be unhappy as well. So everything's connected. And when people start to realize that, they start a bit more respect and appreciation for other people. And then funny how they start to respect themselves. Mm. Because a lot of people who are out there trying to big note themselves don't have much respect for themselves. That's why they're out there trying to convince everybody else, and hopefully they may believe it themselves.
You can only tell yourself so many lies until like they come around and bite you on your backside. Yeah. No, because like this is the thing. I remember, was it a Dove commercial? I can't remember. But like they got different people and they were like interviewing for a job, and they were like, they referred to the associate, and they went, yes, the associate will be it, like, will need you to call on you 24 hours a day. The associate would like, yeah, you have to like provide them with meals, and like the associate, and like they gave like a list of 20 different things, and so you're like, yes. And it was like, they were like, yes, do you think you would like to take the job? And I was like, every one of them was like, oh, no. It's like, no. And then one day, like, basically went, yeah, yes, this job is to be a mother. And it was like, and you were like, the penny dropped, and you saw people like, I get it. And like, more times than not, everyone reached for their phone, and like, they were on the phone calling their mother, like, oh, yeah, like, I'm sorry, I really appreciate you and everything like this. It was like a very sort of emotional, like, sort of like, yeah, you get that sort of spark, and you get to understand it in that moment for what something you take for granted so easily, so much on a day-to-day basis, which, you know what I mean? What kind of blows my mind, and a commercial like stuck with me. Can't remember the brand exactly, but the actual message of it. Yeah.
Well, I would hope that those men who did that, if they had partners at home, but the next call they made was to them.
Mm.
Especially if they were. And this is the thing, the guys who want to have masculine sons, you know, want to be able to play football and, you know, throw baseballs and other things, they're only going to have because when a child is in the womb, it's been first conceived, there is, we may have the gender already sorted, male and female, but the wiring of the brain starts to happen about the seventh week of after pregnancy starts at conception. Excuse me. And at that point, there is, if it's a boy, for instance, that much testosterone hits the child, that then wires the brain for masculinity. If the mother is feeling threatened or unhappy, there's not a lot of testosterone there. The levels of estrogen are high because that's for her nurture as well, to look after herself. So if the man doesn't look after his partner long before she gets pregnant, where she feels safe and loved and supported and everything else, when she has the child, and if this guy is one who's really, I've got to have a masculine son, well, he better start treating his wife gently and lovingly, because the wiring of the brain won't be fully like that strong masculine. It may be more effeminate. And so, as I said, after wars, there were more boys that were born that were gay than at any other times, because going through war, husband's away, woman's got to do all the work, she's under pressure, you know, fighting and all the rest of it over the air, like in England with the bombing and everything else. And, you know, the chemicals that the woman creates were more around survival and protection, you know, around the estrogen than it was around the testosterone. So therefore, next thing you know, the boys that are born, yes, they may have all the male genitals and everything else, but the wiring of the brain is more feminine.
Interesting.
And so this is where I know a lot of the feminists out there all carry on about that. And I go, hang on, stop and listen to the message. We want men to be more respectful of women and more loving. The guys who are all about their macho side and want to be the man and everything else, well, if they understand this, they may come back to being a man and focus on that, and therefore have more respect for their partners. And then we have women who are happy. If the women are happy, the kids are going to be happy as well. See, you know, this is why I had to go with the hashtag we together, because everything I look at, everything's connected. The neuroscience, the expressions, everything comes together. And you start looking at it from all these different points of view, and you really start to understand people. And when you put your focus on understanding all that, I took the focus off me, because I went through some pretty tough times. You know, as I said, not just the divorce, a lot of other stuff that happened before. I grew up with one of my uncles who told my fiance at my first wedding she could do better than me. And that's what I grew up with, because my father died when I was three. I didn't have any male role models except that. And so I could have grew up in a certain way. But it was only, well, I'm 70 now, but when I was 50, I had a few things happen in my life. I met an Aboriginal group and I got invited out bush. That it became a regular occurrence. And after a year, I went through initiation from boyhood into manhood. So the tribal initiation. And that's where I started to understand more about it. This is where I let the ego go, because the three pillars of Aboriginal society is love, humility, and respect. Mm-hmm. Where's the ego male in that? He's not. You know, what you have are men who stand up, who protect their partners, they protect their community. They're loving, they're caring, but they're strong. And so once I started understanding that, that then led on to the Campfire Project later on. But it also led me then to working with men's groups where, okay, we help the boys into manhood, but then how do we help those men, to use a horrible term, how do they help those men become a better man? And that's by teaching them those aspects of being the humility and the respect and, you know, caring for their community and taking the focus off themselves and being more open and caring to others. And all of a sudden they had a lot more respect for themselves. And I go, I didn't have to work on myself. I was able to change myself by helping others.
Yeah. Like, this is the thing. When you say make a better man, make a better person, I would say, one of the things what came out of, well, we're still in the pandemic, but we're not in the pandemic over here in the UK. But what's come from, like, what I've learned from 2020, like, onwards, like, because we are so busy in this world, in society, like, they're sort of like, go, 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 9 to 5, up, going, like, everything in a blur and a whir. Didn't actually have time to stop and breathe. And when, like, the world collectively stopped and exhaled, it was like, oh, wait a second. There was an opportunity to look around. There was an opportunity to sort of like go, wait, hello, what's going on? And to breathe and have that sort of self-reflection on where one's life is, to be able to actually look inwards and go, right, this is like, this is me, and this is like, these are some of the components which I like about myself, love about myself, hate about myself, like need to work on myself. And I know parent, like some people are, I'm a parent, I don't have the time to do it. But I think it's vitally important that you do it. If you want to be a better person, be a better man, be a better member of society, yes, to bring up that next generation, without it, I think you fundamentally make yourself weaker, therefore make the like your family weaker, and like society as a whole weaker without it. And I think we've just been sort of running towards this cliff for the longest time and not knowing it, bit by bit, you know. And I think with people being able to sort of have that sort of year and a bit to sort of like go, oh wait, I think there's a lot more people which have like learned this. I could be wrong, but I feel that's what it feels to me. I don't have any empirical evidence of it, you know.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of us who are feeling the same way. You know, we look at the pandemic, and as I said, there's two sides to every coin. You know, there was some, you know, it's horrible, the number of people who lost their lives and things like that. You know, the pandemic is absolutely terrible. Mm. However, at the same time, on the other side is that we've changed their attitude. We've got more groups coming together and more men stepping up and going, hey, I don't have to be this ego ego character who's out there trying to be in everyone's face and beating their chest and trying to prove themselves. I need to pull back, you know, especially those that had to work from home. They had to then start to work with their partners to be able to, and with the kids, to be able to get the work done, plus also have their life at home. They had to get that harmony happening between everything. And so it made us change. So the pandemic on that side was really good. There was a lot of businesses that, you know, went down the spout. They went, you know, lost their staff, lost their business, their incomes. Mm. Others, their businesses took off. Every situation has positives and negatives. You know, when my first wife left, as I said, I had three boys to raise on my own. They moved out after I got married the second time. My youngest one at the time was about 14 when he went to his mother's. A couple of years later, the second marriage wasn't a long one. I still didn't have these skills. And I was talking to my first ex-wife, probably the first conversation we'd really had in, over 10 years. And she said, well, the youngest boy was staying with her. The other two had moved on and having their own lives. And she said, well, he doesn't respect me, and I don't think any of the boys love or respect me. And I said, well, you're wrong. They do love you. Respect? Well, that's something you haven't earned. But and they're probably not going, you're going to struggle to try and get that respect. And no woman's going to be able to teach them that. And I said, I'm the one who has a problem with it. It's got to come from a man. This is where we have the different generations. You know, if you look at teenagers, now they're making noise, they're out there, they're yahooing and carrying on. Look at wildlife. You see the young bucks in spring. They're all butting heads and trying to prove who's the alpha and everything else. This is getting their positions. That's when, you know, and the boys will do the same thing. This is when you need wiser men, older men, who come up and say, okay, now you've worked out who's who. Now they take the next steps, becoming a true man, not just coming into it and showing your strength and everything else, your muscles, but now you have to have the intelligence as well. And that's when the older men would step in. And most of that we didn't have. So I realized that with my boys, the only way they were going to respect their mother, I had to teach them, which meant I had to change my relationship with her. Like, we didn't fight, I didn't bag her, or she didn't bag me. We just didn't communicate. We didn't need to, separate places. So I set out to organize that so my youngest boy did respect her. And as I said, well, once he respects you, I'm backing off, you've got to maintain it. That's in your hands at that point. And I'm not coming back if you lose it. This is your job. And the end result, she's got three sons who love and respect her. She does talk in ways at the moment where, you know, she pushes their buttons because she's always got to be right, even when she's wrong. And obviously wrong. So
be careful how you say this.
Yeah, well, I think if you ask women and that what's one thing they love about being a woman, they'll probably say always being right.
Get out now. They're coming for you.
Where did you say your audience was? It's over on the Northern Hemisphere. Ooh, I'm safe in Australia.
I've got people in Australia. People listen to this show in Australia. Watch out.
That was where I realized that I had to, you know, if I'd been more sensible about it when I first separated, I'd have had a different relationship. We could have co-parented the boys collectively. Mm. We still co-parented, but separate. One of the boys had said to me one day when he was going to school, he stopped in the doorway and he said, "Oh, I just wanted to tell you that we're lucky to have you." And I went, "Where's my wallet? You're taking me money? What?" No, he said, I said, "What's going on?" He said, no. He said, "We're lucky to have you." I said, "Well, tell me what's going on." He said, "We've got a home here. You don't bag mum. When we go to her place, we've got a home there. She doesn't bag you." And I said, "Well, what about all your friends? Why?" And they said, "Oh, haven't you noticed? They're all down here when they come home from school. They don't go to their place." And I said, "Why?" "Because their mothers and fathers are fighting all the time." Mm. And that's when I realized that was the beginning of it. Now, when my oldest boy was in his mid-30s, she came to me. I had I live on my own. I had a spare room. And she said, "Look, I've got to move out of my place. I've got to, I need somewhere to stay for 3 months. Can I be a lodger? Just pay my way and leave you alone and, separate lives." I went, "Long as it's separate lives, not a problem." Well, she moved out 3.5 years later. And people say, "Well, how could you do that? How could you?" This is a woman who walked out, left you and the boys, said you weren't good enough to be a husband, walked away, and you were able to let her coexist in the house, provided a place for her for 3.5 years. I said, because I looked at it from the point of not what she took out of the marriage, but what we brought into the marriage together. Mm. Without our union, I wouldn't have 3 sons that I love and respect. And I wouldn't have the 6 grandkids I've got now. So when you look at things, there are 2 sides to every coin, and which side you choose to look at is your responsibility. So people who say to something, "Oh, so-and-so made me feel a certain way." No, they didn't. You decided to feel, they may have acted a certain way, but you decided to respond to it the way you responded to it. If you step back and you have a look at it, then you'll have a better understanding and you can look at the other side and then choose out of the 2 sides which way you want to go.
Yeah.
It's your choice.
Absolutely. And this is the thing, choosing to look at it from the positive lens, at looking at it from the realm of gratitude rather than sort of you took this, the realm of negativity and the accusing realm, which not a lot of good things come out of, and just leads to a little bit more conflict down the way. Mm. I think many people would struggle with doing that. And it sounds strange, but if you went, "My ex-wife, she needed somewhere to stay. And she's become my lodger. And it took her 3 years to move out." I can see people throwing the negativity bombs in your direction, left, right, and center. "You're a bit of a cockhold. What the hell is this?" That's not a way to be a man. But she hurt you and she did this and she walked out and you're like, "All right."
And you go, "I'm not a victim." That's the difference. The person who takes that on and goes, "I've got to hate and all the rest of it," you've chosen to be a victim. I'm not a victim. By taking that, and by the way, I am a profile and I knew how to push a button. So I pushed them every now and then. It's a bit of to test and practicing my skill, so to speak.
That's a dangerous game to play.
But I'm not married to her, so it didn't really matter. But what I'm saying here is that it's about, people say, "You tell me I've got to be grateful. I can't be grateful." Well, don't be grateful. Just work out what serves you. Does it serve you to let it go and to feel happier about yourself in your own life? Or does it serve you to be miserable and hate? Mm. Your choice. That's what it comes down to. You choose which one. And if you choose the one where you want to be miserable and everything else, I have a lot of sympathy for you. You know, and I have a lot of support for you if you decide, no, I'm going to have the best, take the best way. It's going to be challenging because if, you know, we're emotional beings, if the other person hurts, it's going to niggle a bit. They may say something and you feel, oh, why did I bother? I should have chucked it in. Well, it just, what do you really want in your life? I want to be happy. You know, people tell me I don't look my age. Well, that's because I don't take all the crap on. I don't hold this stuff in. Because to hate someone, as they say, is like taking poison and hoping they will die. It doesn't happen. You know, it doesn't work that way. The only person who suffers is like the partner who bags their ex-partner to their children. They're the ones that lose their children. They think they're putting down their partner, but really what they're doing is telling their kids that half of them is no good. And if you tell somebody they're no good, they're going to hate you for it. So the person who bags their partner, their ex-partner, is going to lose the love and respect of their children. They're the ones who lose, not the other way around.
Very true. Very true. No, it's a case of, yeah, but it's true. It's simple. It's quite clear when you say it. And I've been aware of it for a number of years. I wouldn't say it's one of those things which came to me immediately, but it's one of those things which had to be learned. But it just saddens me in some respects with regards to that is, it seems to be the default for many people rather than sort of looking for that positive. And when like they find them, like when they've embraced that negative and you, like you're a person which is like on, yeah, I will be there for you when there's a, like with this, like to help support and everything like this. But it comes to a point where sometimes that person is the drowning man, if you get what I mean. As like, because they've surrounded themselves in that sort of realm of negativity so much that if you do go out there to help them, they drag you down. And it's one of those things which I think sometimes, by all means, support, but there has to be a certain degree of work they've got to do beforehand to get that sort of mindset sorted out. And it might be that rock bottom. I don't know how it might manifest at the end of the day, but they do need that sort of moment where, okay, I figured this out and I figured that out. And yeah, now I need the help rather than, you know what I mean? I've got the help for you. And I just like, yeah, let me grab onto you and drag you down, you know?
Yeah. With the way in which you step into it, I used to be a lifesaver. When I first did my training, we used to do the reel and belt swims. This is where they had a reel on the beach and you'd have a belt around you and a long rope and you'd swim out to the person. And you'd have a float that you put around them and it would go around them and you clip it behind them. So it would keep them buoyant. Whenever we came up to them, we didn't come up straight up to them. We pushed this out to them and gave them instructions on what to do. And if they did that and put them around themselves, you're building that rapport with them. You also knew that they couldn't get you. Now you're behind them. They can't grab you. And then you'd put that around them and you put your arm around them in a way in which you think that you'd start to swim and the guys on the beach would start to reel you in. So you took precautions. If I go and help anybody, I don't rush in. And that's the biggest problem today. We see it on Facebook. When anybody's got a problem, we get so caught in this this emotional empathy. So there's three levels of empathy. There's cognitive. I can see you're in pain. I can recognize that. Secondly is the emotional empathy. And women are really good at the emotional empathy. They feel the other person's pain and they want to go in and they want to, you know, hold that person. And they, in some cases, it becomes a pity party. Men, we are compassionate empathy. We like to fix the problem because we don't like the feeling of the emotional side. But where we go wrong is we don't recognize with the women and acknowledge the emotional side. If we do that first, then we can come in with the compassionate side. So on Facebook, we see it all the time. And a lot of the guys now are getting very emotional about it as well. So somebody makes a comment and people take sides straight away. Now, they used to say that a problem shared is a problem halved. No, a problem shared and not acted on is a problem magnified. But a problem shared and acted on with compassionate empathy is then halved. You can actually help that person through things. So it's understanding it. But we see it on Facebook every day. Somebody says something, people take sides, the fight's on, and it just goes on and on. and it will go on for generations to the point that they're fighting and hating each other, but have no idea as to why they were hating each other in the first place. And people respond in a negative way all the time. I had one guy on Facebook, this is all back in about 2016. I don't know whether the post was put up or I commented on it or what it was now, but I made a comment and this guy put a comment in, and he seemed to be a little bit angry about the comment I made. But the way he explained himself, I thought, he's saying the same thing as me, but he doesn't realize it. So I made another comment and he seemed to get angrier. Now, I don't fight. I fix problems. So I just sent him a personal message on Facebook, said, hey, because I took it off air because he had to hold save face. He's there. Here's me. If I got into an argument with him there, he's then got to defend himself. Mm-hmm. So we create a bigger problem. So I sent him a personal message, said, look, I understand what you're saying. It sounds like, you know, you and I are saying the same thing. How about we get off the text, and how about I just ring you on Facebook and we have a chat? Well, he did that. And by the time I finished, he said, well, why did you respond that way? Why didn't you just have a go at me the same as I was having a go at you? I said, because I realized there was something more there and I wanted to find out what it was. Anyway, yeah, by the time we finished, and he said, well, we started talking. I said, well, this is what I do. I'm about profiling, about building relationships. Well, at the end of that, he hired me to profile his kids for him. Then while I was over in London, Gillette and Disney were doing a joint venture with the Star Wars Rogue One launch, and Disney's new players with their new outfits and Gillette with their new razor. And I'm walking around the libraries because it was a 3-hour job, but I took 10 days to have a holiday. And it was one of the best gigs I've ever had. Hired by Disney Films in Gillette, flown to London for the Star Wars launch to be interviewed by the world's press, and got paid for it very handsomely. So I, you know, a great job. But he was then ringing me to ask me when could he start the master course. So that particular profiling his kids and the master course, it was a $10,000 deal. Now, I could have argued with him and not got any of that, but by treating him the right way, the reward I got was a client. And paid quite well on that as well. So as I say to people, if you understand the other person is, like, as I said before, everybody is suffering or has suffered. Everyone's wearing a mask. Everybody's pretending they're not wearing a mask. And everybody has got, there's a result of all their childhood sufferings and rewards. We know that everybody is emotional. Everybody has got some issues. And some people are dealing with it great. And others have pushed it down so far that when you start to talk, it comes back out again. Once you realize that, and you realize that it's not just about you, if you're angry, the other person's angry as well. So why don't you find out what the cause of it is and work on the cause? And it changes your attitude. It takes the focus off, oh, poor me, to, hey, I'm not going to be a victim here. I'm going to be the adult. And next thing you know, when you talk to the other person, you find you've got two adults. Or if you do it the wrong way, you got two children. It's your choice.
Well, if we look in the realm of politics, the world's been controlled by a bunch of kids. That's another story. I have to ask, coming up to the end of our time, but where do you see your journey taking you over in the next few years? What would you like it to go?
Well, just recently I've had a company in Australia that do assessments of courses who have just now started accepting a number of my courses. They're working through the list at the moment, and they're recognising as professional development programs for all industries across Australia and Asia. So any business where they have to get certain points each year to keep their qualifications, they can do my courses. Mm. At the same time, my youngest student is my 13-year-old granddaughter. She started learning how to read people at the age of 11. We're now working on a couple of projects and putting together these flashcards, which will have a picture on the front, the physical feature that we're looking at. On the back, it will have how to read that trait, what it means, and how to talk to the person. So she's done all the text on the back. That was part of her homework over the last 2 years. So she's my business partner on that. And outside of that, my target is to create and train my competition. Now, we need more people doing what I'm doing because there's 8 billion people on the planet, or near enough to, these days. I can't service all of them. But we need more people doing it. But they've got to be doing it right. And to make sure they're doing it right, I have to train them. So I'm setting out to train as many people as I can who won't just use it in their business for selling or other things, but will go out and train other people. Because as a leader, my job is to make myself redundant by raising others up to do what I can do, what I'm doing, and hopefully do it better than I'm doing it. And then I can look at it and go, yep. Yeah. Because as I say, what you do for yourself dies with you, but what you do for the community and for others isn't always will be eternal. And I've done that in just about every career that I've had. I've always raised other people up, because if I didn't, I couldn't move on. If I'm indispensable, I'm in a jail. I've got to be able to move, you know, bring other people up, which frees me to go on and do other things. Mm-hmm. And we need more people in business, not just managing people, but leading in that particular way. If we do that, people are going to be happier, less domestic violence, less bullying in the workplace, happier kids. Everything is impacted in a positive way. And that's a campaign I'm on. So I've already decided at the age of 70, I'm still never going to retire. I'll be doing what I'm doing, been doing it in new ways, and hopefully training a lot of people who will take on the mantle and take it further than I've ever taken it.
Ah, perfect. Perfect. Mm. Ah, Stephen. Stephen? No, sorry. My mind's traveling. But I feel like there's a Stephen I need to talk to about some of this at some point. Alan, I have to say, thank you for coming on today. You, sir, have been a joy, education, and a bright light in this dark world. I have to say, thank you very much.
You're welcome. If it's any use to your people, I've got a free course that they can have a shot at themselves, 28 minutes that takes them. It'll teach them a couple of traits they can go out and practice reading people. We'll also give them an idea of where people's eyes move when they're sourcing information as well. So I'm happy to give you that link, and you can share it in the show notes.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, and talking of the show notes, all the details and all the information to find Alan will be in that. So you can find him, connect with him. Yes, profile some people if you want. Remember, if you do that, use the power responsibly.
That's it. Yeah. Use it for good. Stay away from the dark side.
Sorry. Yes. Thank you, Alan, for coming on today. You are a superstar. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'd like to say thank you to you, my friends, my life warriors, for sticking with us, staying with us to the end of the show. Please stay safe, stay well, be awesome, be excellent, be fantastic. Be all the positive bees you can be in this world, and then some. Thank you very much, guys. Have a great day. Yes. Peace. And we are...